Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown. It is Wednesday, September the 20th, and we are very excited because if you're a kid, it is your day to eat all you want. It is National Fried Rice Day. It is National Pepperoni Pizza Day. It is National String Cheese Day. I know if you're an adult like me, your stomach probably started rumbling, but don't worry. We have the cure for all of that. We have the most calming, soothing news that you could imagine. And joining me this week, because Steven is out doing storage field day, is my good friend Chris Grundemann. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here as well, because we've got some cool stories coming up. We've got some exciting news about some new product releases. And unfortunately, we have a big story about something that was unintentionally released. And we'll get to that in just a little bit.
Yeah, Tom. Paisler is partnering with Network Field Day presenter Backbox to bring config backup to your enterprise. Backbox has the capability to save network device configuration data as well as other critical information like license keys. Backbox can validate these backups and restore bare metal devices if necessary. Paisler is integrating monitoring capabilities with their flagship PRTG platform to allow you to manage the status of your configuration backup and restore jobs. So Tom, I mean, I think visibility into this in-depth backup system is probably pretty interesting, yeah?
It is. And we've seen Backbox already this year a couple of times. They've presented it at Networking Field Day and also during Cisco Live. And a lot of the capabilities that they have, you know, you kind of think to yourself, I'm like, man, why didn't somebody think of that sooner? Because we're always looking to pull this information, right? Like I can remember writing scripts to do config backups. But more importantly, the thing that I think is important for them is like they can do things like pull license keys. Like I can't think of the number of times that I have like a file where I have important license keys that I need to plug back in after the system reboots from getting the config put back on it. And Backbox just says, no, we'll stick it in there and it'll work. But one of the biggest drawbacks to that is, do I know that the backups are running? And more importantly, you know, how long are they taking? I need metrics on all of that stuff. And that's what Paisler is trying to do with PRTG. Really, I remember using it back in the day when it was just MRTG. And it was just like, okay, it's a routing traffic graph or whatever. But they're really building it into a big platform. You may remember back in June, we talked about the fact that they were partnering with NetBrain to do some other stuff. And it's all driven by the fact that Paisler can consume these APIs and kind of produce visibility on a dashboard. And I like what they're trying to accomplish. What they're saying is you can use all of these other tools like Backbox. It's a very specific focused tool, but you can integrate that API interface into PRTG and use it as our one-stop shop. That is super valuable for a lot of people out there. And I for one, appreciate what they're trying to accomplish. I can't wait to see what they have to say about it. And honestly, you will definitely want to stay tuned because Backbox will be coming to Networking Field Day very soon. And I'm sure that they'll be talking about this and a lot more things. All right. Chris, today Lenovo announced a brand new edge-focused AI solution. Lenovo TruScale for Edge brings an infrastructure as a service platform to the world of edge computing. TruScale will allow Lenovo to sell solutions to customers looking to ramp up their presence at the edge and start to work on complex subjects like everyone's favorite AI. Mm-hmm. The centerpiece of this platform is the Lenovo ThinkEdge SE455V3. That's a mouthful because it also contains an AMD EPYC 800 CPU. Now, I know that edge computing is a very hot topic, and Steven has been talking a lot about it on utilizing edge. But Chris, what are your thoughts on Lenovo kind of coming out with this new edge platform and really focusing it on AI?
Yeah, overall, this is great. I think one thing, just to back up the history of this, right? TruScale was actually announced back in February of 2019. It's essentially an infrastructure as a service and device as a service offering. So it's really everything as a service under Lenovo. And what's kind of interesting about it when they first came out, you know, the 4 years ago, is they're looking at, you know, I've heard people call them being kind of a general contractor, right? They basically are promising this single point of contact for at least eventually all of their as-a-service offerings through this TruScale brand. The initial partners included folks like SAP and Nutanix and VMware, Microsoft, also on the kind of, you know, resale and integration side with CDW and Synnex. And so it's a really interesting just overall kind of the whole thing as a service, right? We can come install it, maintain it, manage it. It's truly infrastructure as a service from a vendor or manufacturer, which is pretty interesting. And then what's announced today is TruScale for Edge and AI services. The idea here is to give companies this immediate scalable access to next generation AI anywhere, I think is one of the quotes I heard. You know, really, it's about this kind of bringing that cost model and potentially cost benefits, and definitely the quick start, right? One of the interesting things I think about these infrastructure as a service plays, especially from Lenovo, is you basically get all of the gear you need day one, but then you're paying for it, you know, over time, instead of having to finance, you know, this right up front, which is really interesting. So you get this kind of pay-as-you-go model and get your, you know, whatever you're needing at the edge. A lot of it's AI these days, whether that's generative AI or computer vision, virtual assistants, these kind of things are all really interesting. So that cost modeling and the partnerships involved are pretty interesting. They've added new partners. As you mentioned, AMD is in here now, and Intel, NVIDIA, Qualcomm as well is in the mix. So, and all of this comes together in this new Lenovo ThinkEdge SE455V3, as you said, with the AMD EPYC 8004 series processors. A couple of things here, right? One, they're calling this the most powerful edge server on the market. And I'm starting to think a little bit about those car commercials where every car is the best in its class because we've just created a bunch of new classes. I don't know if that's exactly what's going on here, but it feels a little familiar, right? When you start saying the most powerful edge server, what does that exactly mean? I'm not sure. But what is interesting is the AMD EPYC processors do focus on the performance, but also really focused on energy efficiency, platform density, quiet operations. And so that's a lot of what we're talking about when we talk about edge. And then obviously also with the other partnerships, Qualcomm is also bringing in their Cloud AI 100, which is an AI inference accelerator, which again, kind of focused on power efficiency, scale, process node advancements, all these kind of things that are really important at the edge. And I'm starting to wonder a little bit, you know, how much of these innovations are going to stay, quote unquote, at the edge versus is this technology we just need everywhere, right? There's lots of concerns about power usage at data centers and these kind of things. So, you know, can we just bring these efficiencies everywhere or at least a lot of places? I think that could be very interesting as well. So lots of interesting news there, and definitely really focused on kind of furthering the edge and the cost models at the edge. One of those partners, Intel, also had some other exciting news coming out of Intel Innovation this week, Tom. Intel showed off their first chiplet-based design using the Universal Chiplet Interconnect Express, or UCIe, as the bus powering the chiplet data exchanges. They also talked about using glass substrate in CPUs in the future as a way to keep Moore's Law relevant into the 2030s even, potentially. It wouldn't be a presentation in 2023, of course, without talking about AI. So Intel introduced their Ultra series processor that has an integrated neural processing unit, or NPU, to help provide local inferencing support. Oh, and Sierra Forest will have a 288-core variant coming out soon. Tom, is that too many cores?
It's never too many cores. More cores for the core gods. I saw the announcement from Pat Gelsinger that, you know, they kicked off yesterday with Intel Innovation Forum. And, you know, this is what happens when the nerds are in charge. Like, running down the list of things that you mentioned. First of all, we know that Intel's developing chiplets, but they've developed a whole new bus for chiplets. That's great. That means that this isn't a flash in the pan. They really are going to start developing these chiplet-based designs to kind of take advantage of a lot of efficiencies that they've created over the years. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time you build a new CPU. And I know that a lot of hay has been made about the fact that Intel is kind of on this roadmap now where they're releasing 5 architectures in 4 years kind of thing. It would have been easier to say they're releasing a new architecture like, what, every 9-10 months? Whatever. Math doesn't work there. But, like, they're really starting to innovate where it matters, not on, you know, this processor's being held back because we can't get this particular little chipset piece working with the rest of it. That's gone. The glass substrate thing was kind of interesting because, you know, they're basically saying we're reaching the limits of what we can do with current materials, but if we rev these materials just enough and we can start doing some cool things with it, man, look what we're going to be able to accomplish. And I think it's a truism in the industry that the closer we get to invalidating Moore's Law, the more creative we get with ways to apply the things that we've learned to keep Moore's Law relevant. You ask people today what Moore's Law is, they wouldn't be able to tell you that, oh yeah, it's Intel's founder talking about CPU architectures. They just know that it's a thing that makes stuff go faster. So I like that Intel's working towards that, and they're not just, you know, effectively resting on their laurels. The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting was the fact that they've kind of embraced this AI thing. Yeah, I know we talk about it a lot, but it is kind of dominating the industry. Everyone is building these optimized architectures to work on AI. More importantly, what Intel is trying to do is they're trying to keep the inferencing processing local to the unit. They're trying to make it happen in the CPU, which addresses some of the concerns that people have with this. And we have a story about that coming up pretty soon about what happens when you don't consider what happens when you're putting a lot of AI focused, you know, generational stuff out there on the internet. But I like that Intel is basically saying, you know, if you're trying to run a data center and you need to use AI, but you're a little bit concerned about how it's going to operate, you know, use our chips. And then, of course, you know, more cores. But like you said, one of the things that makes Sierra Forest so important is that they're not just packing cores in here and creating like this white hot ball of nickel that's going to eat through the data center floor. They're doing more cores at lower power to kind of optimize what those cores are capable of doing and reducing the power draw in general. Fewer servers with more cores that run more efficiently will reduce the power budget of a data center overall. And I think that that speaks a lot to some of the sustainability goals that companies like Intel are trying to put out there. It doesn't hurt that it also means that they're going to be, you know, running their fabs pretty close to the line to optimize that kind of stuff. So I applaud it. I mean, this isn't like getting into drones and you know, autonomous vehicles. This is getting back to Intel's bread and butter. This is CPUs that go really fast. Every 18 months, they get twice as fast. And they're innovating in the materials market. So I think that there's some real value there. And I can't wait to see, you know, more of Intel stuff. And you know we're going to cover it because we love talking about Intel here on The Rundown. All right, we do have a story from our friends over at Cisco, because they announced last week that their HyperFlex data center HCI solution has reached the end of its life. You may recall about 2-3 weeks ago, we talked about the fact that Cisco and Nutanix had created a global partnership that they're going to run Nutanix software on Cisco UCS. And a lot of people at the time were asking, well, what does that mean for HyperFlex? Well, we know now. It means that Cisco is committed to delivering all of the HyperFlex features that are currently on the committed section of the roadmap. But anything that was in the planning stages as of September the 12th is not going to be delivered. Cisco and Nutanix are working on migration strategies and licensing to be able to move customers from HyperFlex to Nutanix. It's not a straight one-to-one crossover. But my question for you, Chris, is this a recognition of the fact that customers of HyperFlex didn't really want it? They just wanted to be able to run Nutanix on UCS. And now that they can, we're going to put it out to pasture?
It certainly looks that way. I mean, you can look at just the market numbers, right? If you look back, and you know, I don't have a date on these, but you know, the last time I checked, Nutanix had a market share of about 58% in converged infrastructure, right? Over half. And the Cisco HyperFlex platform had less than 7%. So the wallets have definitely voted on this one. Nutanix seems to be winning. And Cisco is, as they do, you know, astutely seeing that happening and getting on board. What I think is really interesting here, though, Tom, is Cisco tried to do this in the very beginning. If you remember back, HyperFlex was announced in March of 2016. And what actually happened is just before Nutanix went public in 2015, Cisco put in a bid and tried to acquire Nutanix. It didn't pan out. I think they might have been a billion or so short from what Nutanix wanted at the time. And Cisco kind of pivoted and bought SpringPath instead. SpringPath? Who knows? That was what storage and data services software was built by, that was put into the UCS to create HyperFlex, right? So that was a SpringPath product. So Cisco tried to make the right bet and failed back when they couldn't. They've had a good run of it, though. As of March 2024, which is when the actual end of sale will happen, there will be no sales after that date. The HyperFlex platform will be 8 years old. So that's a long, long time in technology history and in Cisco history as well. The last ship date will be a little bit after that in June. No word yet on when end of support will be, but I think it'll probably be obviously quite a bit after that. And as you've mentioned, this is a pretty deep partnership. Nutanix and Cisco announced their partnership last month and have now extended it with this whole thing. It's basically Cisco's SaaS managed compute and networking solution with Nutanix's cloud platform, which includes Nutanix Cloud Infrastructure, Nutanix Cloud Manager, Nutanix Unified Storage, and the Nutanix desktop services. So a complete package here. As you said, there's not a straight line to migrate from HyperFlex into the Nutanix solution, although they are working on migration efforts. They have a migration guide that's a pretty comprehensive document. And obviously Cisco will also offer migration services for customers if you want to get them involved and pony up on this. This whole thing has a new name, which is Cisco Compute Hyperconverged with Nutanix. And it can run on certain qualified HyperFlex M6 hardware with the purchase of a new Nutanix software license. So there is a path, even if it isn't a straight line. What's also interesting about this partnership is Cisco ACI has been integrated with the Nutanix cloud platform. So that's kind of interesting to me. Nutanix has integrated its built-in hypervisor, AHV, as well as the Nutanix Flow Network Security with Cisco's application-centric infrastructure, Virtual Machine Manager, the VMM, which provides security policies through Nutanix into Cisco ACI, which is kind of cool. It also works the other way. Cisco ACI is integrated with Nutanix Flow Network Security to enable micro-segmentation and contextual security policies for VMs that are running in Nutanix through that SDN technology. So there's a pretty in-depth partnership. It looks pretty cool going forward. Obviously, like you said, Nutanix is what's hot out there right now, and Cisco is meeting them where they are and bringing their customers what they want, it looks like.
All right, Chris, we had a story we wanted to take a bit of a closer look at, so I'm going to pose a question to you. A cloud giant, an inconfigured security permission on a storage bucket, an embarrassing data exposure. Who am I talking about? I'll give you a hint. For once, it's not Amazon. Because Microsoft's AI division just found out that they made a little mistake. 3 years ago, they accidentally leaked 38 terabytes to a public GitHub repo while they were contributing to AI learning models. A security research team just this week found out that there was that exposure, which came from a misconfigured Azure's blob storage URL that was overly permissive and difficult to manage. Shared Access Signature, or SAS, is a tokenized system that's designed to give teams full control over file sharing. However, according to the security researchers, it is very difficult to manage, makes it appear almost impossible to make it do what you want to do, and that's where we ended up. The leaked data included passwords, keys, and an archive of internal Microsoft Teams messages. Now, I know that Microsoft Azure has gotten egg on its face a lot recently because of misconfigurations, key theft, and now, turns out, about 38 terabytes worth of oopsie that got published for 3 whole years. So, Chris, you know, you and I both kind of love to talk about the security stuff, and I don't think that we're talking enough about this move fast, break things, expose the world kind of mentality that's happening. So I'm going to let you kind of start out here, not only about this particular leak, but in general, when it comes to Azure, are customers starting to lose faith in Microsoft's ability to keep them safe?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know, right? I mean, if you remember back the beginnings of cloud, the first kind of heartburn that people had around moving to public cloud things was security, right? There was a lot of enterprises, a lot of companies that just at the very beginnings wouldn't do it, wouldn't think about it. It was not an option because of these security concerns. This, you know, whole idea of the shared security model has kind of grown out of that, where, and it's not just, you know, Microsoft and Azure, right? It's also Amazon and AWS. It's also Google and GCP. It's Oracle and OCI across the board, right? What, you know, all the way down, DigitalOcean, everybody, right? Linode, whoever you're talking about. There's this shared security model, and it's kind of like, hey, we're, you know, it reminds me a lot of the demarcation kind of battles in early telco days, right? Where, you know, where does the service end? You know, if your router breaks, do you call AT&T or do you have to deal with it yourself? And how do you figure that out? And we've done this in the cloud as well, where we say, okay, you know, we're going to secure our infrastructure. You secure everything on top of it, which seems to make sense at first blush. But as we've seen here, even Microsoft's own team, right? People who work at Microsoft couldn't figure out how to secure Microsoft's cloud for their own data, right? Whether it was confusing or they just missed a button or whatever. And so I think it may require us to start kind of rethinking that shared security model a little bit, at least in terms of defaults, right? Why is everything default open? Should it be default closed instead? Are there additional ways that these cloud giants now can help their users who are often not massive teams coming out of Microsoft, but small businesses, startups, right? Folks who don't have a dedicated security staff, who don't have dedicated cloud architects who are going to go in there and learn all the things about every cloud to be able to figure out how to secure everything. How do we make this simpler and easier to use? I think better defaults is one way. Easier control panels and things like that is another way. But I think this is a problem that definitely needs to be solved. Whether or not folks are lighting their torches and bringing their pitchforks to Microsoft's gates just yet, I think we maybe should in to some degree.
I think you're right. And one of the problems that you run into is, and this happened to me a couple of weeks ago working on a completely unrelated product. I wasn't even working on an IT thing, but someone had created this really complicated way to share audio between a speaker system and everything like that. And it worked really well as long as he was messing with it. And then as soon as somebody else had to touch it, nothing made sense. And so the problem that we run into when we create these, like SaaS is a really good example, not software as a service, but the security access method that Microsoft has created. It's overly complicated. Like if Microsoft can't figure out how to permit these files only to be shared and then nothing else, you have to go back to the drawing board. When you look at what was in that particular bucket that was shared, like my security alarm bells just started ringing. It's like, why were you co-locating AI models with internal chat archives, with keys, with passwords, with Microsoft's employee backups? Like, in a perfect world, none of that makes sense to be in the same bucket. That needs to be separate buckets. I don't care if you've created the security structure that says, well, we're only going to show you this, we're only going to show you that. It's like preventing a fire. How do you prevent a fire? You don't keep the things that can burn next to things that are a flame source. And in this case, if those things had been separated out by buckets, let's just say that SaaS didn't work for this particular bucket. If you had only exposed maybe a couple of AI models that you weren't intending to get out there on the internet, big deal. But now, like, you've got to answer for the fact that you stored 38 terabytes of data in a bucket to begin with. You left it so that nobody really understood how it worked. Like, can you not run an audit report and go, okay, this is what I can see, this is what I can't, this is what these users can see? Like, there's basic security tenets that are being violated here. And I think that, you know, we talk about it all the time in the industry. You've got to understand those basics. You've got to get back to that. Principle of least privilege doesn't mean anything if you are just leaving stuff out for people to find. Like, you know, think about, you know, is something as simple as, like, go back to Mission Impossible in the 60s. Like, we put the folder in the safe. Well, now it doesn't matter who has access to, who has the rights to read the folder. If the safe is locked and nobody knows the combination except for one person, that's the arbiter of who can see the data. We're not going to just say, okay, well, we're going to put it in this box and we're going to put the box in the corner and we're going to make sure that only a couple people know where the box is. All it's going to take is somebody to go over and start looking through the boxes to find it. And I know that it kind of seems like almost, you know, kitschy and retro to talk about it like that. But when we had to secure data that was printed somewhere, we had a lot more stringent security protections because we were so worried that people were just going to blunder in and find it. And now that everything is computerized and digitized and stored places, we think, oh, well, we'll just create access rules and people won't be able to see it. Yeah, they won't until you misconfigure the access rules and you don't have a little alarm bell that goes off going, hey, did you really mean to do that? And I think that one place that Amazon has actually done a really good job of this recently is they have changed the permission model for S3 buckets to be overly less permissive by default. We're not just going to open the whole thing up and make you go in and secure it. We're going to secure it, basically lock it down and make you go open things up. One, it keeps them from getting egg on their face when something goes wrong. But two, it forces you to make the active decision to expose this particular data. So that means that if you come back later and go, well, I didn't mean to do that, then Amazon can go, well, you did check all four of these boxes to say that you did want this to be shared and you opened it to the public or whatever. That's on you, not us. Microsoft is going to have to get to a model like that. And it needs to be clear cut, straightforward, easy to understand. If you click this box, these things will be exposed. Here's a list of those things. If you are okay with this, click I agree or type I agree or something like that. And I don't think that the cloud issues are going to go away just because cloud is hot and new and exciting. I think they're going to get worse as we continue to dump technology out there that isn't quite ready to go. We need more of a testing structure to make that happen.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I wonder if it's not worth kind of thinking back to some more traditional data center security approaches or models, Tom. I mean, you know, I won't advocate network address translation as a security mechanism, but putting things on their own VLANs that are not accessible to the internet and only accessible through, you know, different gateways or jump boxes or things like that. You know, there's a lot of practices that we may have given up with the public cloud where we're just kind of everything is online on the internet by default. It's really interesting. I do take your point that we do have this shared responsibility, right? I mean, our teams do need to pay attention to what they're doing. But I think also the platforms themselves need to provide easier ways to be more secure, and especially by default.
Yeah, I would agree. And we're going to continue to cover these stories because this problem isn't going to go away. And Microsoft is in a bit of turmoil right now. Because you may recall, you know, there have been outside in people who have stolen signing keys and they've gotten access to things that they shouldn't. I think that it's a lax security procedure in general that needs to be addressed. Maybe we need to get some security training videos and have the Microsoft team go through them, you know, the basics, like, you know, this is where we store things. This is where we don't store things. This is how we need to make sure we do that kind of stuff. And more importantly, I think the teams need to integrate more. They need to understand that just because you drop something in a bucket doesn't mean that it's, safe forever. In fact, one of the smartest things that I've ever seen from a security perspective has been just assume that you've been breached. What can they see? If the answer is too much, then the solution is not to lock the controls down. It's to move the data somewhere where it can't be accessed. And I think if we get back to that, if we take a little bit more time up front to plan it properly, we're going to spend a lot less time on the back doing PR work to help people understand, oh, no, really, it wasn't that bad. All right. Well, we've got a few things coming up in the next couple of weeks that we definitely want to make sure that you're checking out. The first one is actually happening right now. We're going to be doing Storage Field Day 26 this week out in Silicon Valley. Stephen Foskett's got a great lineup of presenters. He's also at the Storage Developers Conference from SNEA. So I'm sure we're going to be getting some great updates from cool stuff going on there. In fact, I understand that there's a really exciting product announcement coming from Solidigm today. You're going to want to tune in and check that out at techfieldday.com. Then back a couple weeks from now in October, Stephen's going to be doing Edge Field Day. That's going to be October 4th and 5th. If you want to learn more about that, we've got details on our website, techfieldday.com. And then just a couple weeks after that, October 18th and 19th, is going to be Cloud Field Day 18, which is taking place during the Open Compute Project Summit out in Silicon Valley. I think we're going to have lots of news coming around there. Chris, what are some things you've got going on that people should definitely check out?
Yeah, I'd love anybody who works in IT or is interested about working in IT to check out the Imposter Syndrome Network podcast. We tell the origin stories of technology professionals, yes, just like superheroes, to help kind of demystify different career paths and the fact that we all make mistakes from time to time. So check that out. Also coming up, if you're interested in network automation, the Network Automation Forum is putting on AutoCon Zero in November 13th and 14th in Denver, Colorado. So go to networkautomation.forum. If you're interested in being at that event and joining the conversation.
And I will say that the Imposter Syndrome Network podcast has been doing an amazing job. I recently listened to the Vint Cerf story. If you are a fan of the internet, you should listen, if only because you get to understand that one of the men who was responsible for creating the TCP/IP protocol may be the most humble engineer on the planet. And it was just wonderful to hear you interview him. It was wonderful to hear some of his stories. Even 50, 60 years on, the man has a wealth of knowledge. And I'm glad that you were able to sit down and talk to him.
Yeah, he's a great person.
Yeah. I'm also glad that you were all able to join us for the rundown this week. Remember, we're back usually around 12:30 Eastern time on Wednesday. We are on our website at gestaltit.com where you can see show notes and articles that we've linked to. You can follow us on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/gestaltitvideo. You can even check us out as a podcast if you prefer to do this while you're out for a run or you're washing the dishes, whatever it happens to be. Just look for Gestalt IT Rundown in your favorite podcast application. We'll be back next week with more great stories. Until then, take care of yourself. Enjoy some fried rice and maybe some string cheese today, but we will see you very soon.